Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 327 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the second part of a two-part interview, Andrew Cowan speaks with Bethan Roberts about escaping the noose of perfectionism, what research brings to the writing process, and what write what you know really means in every genre. You can hear the first part of this interview in the preceding episode, number 326. We rejoin Andrew and Bethan as they finish discussing Andrew's first novel, Pig, and consider the impact of its critical success on his continuing writing career.
Andrew Cowan was born in Corby, Northamptonshire in 1960 and educated at Beanfield Comprehensive and the University of East Anglia, where he is now a Professor of Creative Writing. He graduated from UEA with an MA in Creative Writing in 1985. His teachers there were Malcolm Bradbury and Angela Carter. His first novel, Pig, about two teenagers, Danny and Sarinda, who spend a summer looking after a pig and falling in love on the edge of a crumbling industrial town, was published in 1994. Pig won a Betty Trask Award, the Sunday Times Young Writer of the Year Award, the Authors Club First Novel Award, the Scottish Arts Council Book Award, and the Ruth Haddon Memorial Prize. It was also shortlisted for five other awards. After Pig came five other novels: Common Ground, a funny and tender story of a man facing up to new parenthood; Crustaceans, a haunting and poetic meditation on loss; What I Know, in which Mike, a private detective, decides to spy on his own family with amusing and yet devastating results; Worthless Men, a richly imagined historical novel about lives in a market town during the Great War; and in 2019, Your Fault, an unsettlingly accurate portrayal of growing up in a 1960s new town, which Margaret Atwood found elegant, unsparing, and meticulously detailed. The same could be said of all Andrew Cowan's novels. His creative writing guidebook, The Art of Writing Fiction, was published in 2011 and has become an invaluable resource for anyone teaching the craft. You published that first one and it was incredibly successful, even though perhaps you didn't enjoy it as you should. And you talked a bit about your perfectionism and how difficult that was to overcome. From what I've read, I think that all those prizes and everything didn't enable you to then believe that you could perhaps leave the perfectionism behind and complete a novel a little bit quicker. is that true to say? Probably it took a couple of novels for you to get out of that. I think you called it a form of mental illness, I've read somewhere else.
Yeah.
Can you talk a bit about how you, if you feel you have left perfectionism behind, how you did it, or whether you've kind of managed to stick a little elbow out somewhere?
Yeah, I think I have found a way of dealing with it. I haven't conquered it. I found a way of dealing with it. I did have a two-book deal for Pig and for what was eventually published as Common Ground. And so I had a publisher's deadline for Common Ground, and I had the success of Pig. And I think those two things, a deadline drawing me on and success propelling me forward, they meant that I wrote my second novel quite quickly, 2.5 years compared to 6 years for Pig. And when it was published, it didn't win prizes like Pig had done. It got half as many reviews as Pig had got. Half as many of them were favourable. And Pig had also secured a lot of translation deals, so it's published internationally, and Common Ground secured half as many foreign rights deals. So in comparison to Pig, it felt like a failure. I realise now that actually it was published really quite successfully and I should be very proud of it, but at the time it felt like a failure, and I began to feel that I'd been a little bit incautious and I'd written it too quickly. That's why it failed, because I dropped my guard. I wasn't perfectionist with Common Ground as I was with Pig, and as I should have been. So then I started writing my third novel, Crustaceans, and now I'm trying to compensate for what felt like the failure of Common Ground by trying to make every single sentence perfect. And I made myself quite ill with that, and that was another very slow book. It took me 4 years to write that one. And after 3 years, I was nowhere near finished, and I'd actually gone 2.5 years over my delivery date with the publisher for that book. So I wasn't earning money, I wasn't writing, but I was officially contracted to be the writer of this third novel. And I was stuck. And I read a book, Dorothea Brand, Becoming a Writer, which advocated the practice of automatic writing as a way of freeing you up. And I had no other ideas, no better ideas. So I tried it for the first time. I allowed myself to do automatic writing, to just write any old stuff, just poured it onto the page. And I found that actually a lot of it was raw sewage, but in amongst it there was good stuff. And I realized from that experience that I could find a way of escaping my own, or the shackles of my own perfectionism, by giving myself permission to step outside the shackles for an hour, just an hour, and write whatever you like. It's okay, it's only an hour, and no one's going to read it. And so I did that, and then I would go back to it in the afternoon and type it up. And as I'm typing up this automatic writing, I'm refining it, I'm finding ways of improving it, I'm making editorial decisions about what not to type up, I'm starting to rearrange it. And so I'm in this sort of relationship with my own writing, where in the morning I'm being relatively free, and in the afternoon I'm allowing the perfectionist into the room to work on what I produced in the morning. And so that's become my process ever since. So Crustaceans took 3 years to get less than halfway in, and then less than a year to finish. And I realised that I discovered a method for circumventing my own perfectionism.
That's a good method.
I advocate it
to
my students all the time.
Yeah. Going back to that kind of nuts and bolts thing of how you get words on a page, how a story grows, I think after you wrote Crustaceans, you said that, and I'm quoting you, "I don't, as a rule, think or imagine or invent or plan before writing. I put down a sentence, I revise it endlessly. I put down another. Slowly, very slowly, a world develops, suggested by images, details, etc. Characters develop in the same way. They don't exist prior to my writing them down." And my question, I suppose, is, was that process the same for your historical novel, Worthless Men? Because I know you did a lot of research when you wrote that. Did you find you could do that in the same way, or did you have to adapt your technique?
So I mentioned that after I graduated from my MA in creative writing, there were a couple of years where I didn't do much writing, but I did interview a lot of old people about their memories of Norwich in the period between about 1910 and 1936. And I deposited the tapes and transcripts with the local library, but I kept some photocopies of some of the transcripts, because I became quite attached to some of the people I interviewed. They were like surrogate grandparents. And I kept some of my favourite, a record of some of my favourite conversations with them. And for about 20 years, I had that little archive of material sitting there in a box file in a cupboard, kind of asking one day to be made into a novel. And it was all details about the historical period, interesting details about the way that life was formerly. So there wasn't a story there, there wasn't a narrative, there weren't any characters, but there was a lot of detail, backdrop. There was a lot of backdrop. And the reason why I didn't write that novel for so long is because I never had the story. And then I watched a documentary. It was about a statistician called Fisher, that's his surname, I can't remember his first name, but he was the father of the science of the modern science of statistics. It was an Open University documentary, and I was fascinated by it because he was also a eugenicist, and he was an irascible man. He was brilliant in very many ways. He was forward-thinking in a lot of ways, but he held these views which, from our perspective, looking back 80 to 100 years, are abhorrent and seem to be the cause of most of the calamities of the 20th century. And I thought I could write about a character like him situated in a place that really only exists in my archive of oral history recordings. So I had my first character, and then as I read the transcripts, I started to think about the experience of soldiers coming home from the First World War, from the trenches. There was one very vivid detail where one of my interviewees was describing his father coming back from the trenches and being covered in enormous pussy boils as a result of being bit by insects in the trenches, and smelling. His father just smelled horrible. And he remembered this as a very small boy, practically his earliest memory. And so I wondered about having a character who was home from the trenches. And gradually, as I read further into the transcripts, I imagined other characters and how they might interrelate around the theme of eugenics, eugenics being one of the justifications for the First World War. And I wanted to set it all on the home front. And my soldier who comes back from the war, as I started writing it, becomes a ghost. I realised that actually he got killed in the trenches, but he's coming back and revisiting what he's left behind, what he's lost. And so I think with that book, more than any previous book, I did have characters who were separate from me. There was nothing in the book that was particularly autobiographical, whereas each of my other books is quite autobiographical. I was drawing much more on the historical record, and I was depending much more on research than I was imagination.
Mm.
But the actual method of, or process of putting words on the page, and the experience of trying to manipulate sentences, that was the same, no difference there at all.
I guess you must have to negotiate some position with the facts. Did you find that that was freeing in some way, or was that more difficult?
I used to give a lecture here at UEA to the MA students, talking about my writing process and my research methods. And I would always show them the research material that went into the writing of Pig, which is basically two sides of A4. On one side, I've got some typewritten notes about pigs, their behaviour.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side, I've got some typewritten notes about gardening, because the boy in the book cultivates an allotment. And that was all the research I did for that book. Everything else was what I know.
Yeah.
And then I show them the pile of box files that went into the writing of Worthless Men, which is almost as tall as me, that pile of research material.
Mm.
And I began with the oral history transcripts, but the more I wrote, the more I realised how little I knew, and the more research I then did.
Mm.
And so that book became quite research heavy. And it's very important, I realised in the writing of it, that you don't write out of a sense of obligation to the research, so that whatever you've researched now has to go into the book.
Mm.
You only use what research is useful to the idea you have for the book.
Mm.
But it's quite important, I think, if you're writing an historical novel, that the stuff that is historically traceable to an archive, or is traceable to an historical archive, is accurate. But that's, I think, the same for if you're writing about the contemporary world as well. You want certain things to be factually correct. And then once you've constructed your scaffold of factually correct stuff, you can invent the edifice that scaffold is supporting.
Mm.
And then the scaffold kind of falls away and it takes on an imaginative life of its own. There are a lot of ways in which the writing of a historical novel is not that different from the writing of a contemporary novel. If I'm writing, for instance, What I Know, which is about a private detective, a humdrum private detective living in a neighbourhood much like mine, on the school run, much like I used to be on the school run daily, taking my daughter to school, I can draw for the purpose of that novel on my own experience to a large degree, but I've never been a private eye. And so in order to authenticate him on the page as a private eye, I met a private detective who was very kind. In a way, he had no choice because he was my stepbrother. but I was actually meeting him for more or less the first time. Uh-huh. That's another story. But anyway, it turns out that my stepbrother that I never really met previously was a private detective. And he gave me a correspondence course in being a private detective that he'd done. He'd followed this course and he'd got his qualification. And so I had all this material on how to be a private eye. So then that becomes the research for that novel, which makes that novel feel authentic. And then I'm writing about Norwich in 1916 for the purpose of Worthless Men. And of course, I'm drawing a lot on my oral history archive and other archival research. But again, there's an awful lot which comes from what I know, because I'm having to imagine what it is to walk around the street on a particular day in August when there's the stench of the cattle market and there is a rainstorm, you know, and you draw upon your experiences of being near livestock and being caught in the rain. And I think this is the essence of the advice, write about what you know, is that even if you're writing about little green homunculi on planet Zog, or you're writing about Walter Barley, a dead First World War soldier revisiting his childhood home in 1916. Even if you're writing about these quite alien experiences, the way in which you bring them to life on the page is to donate what you know about being alive in the world. So you're still drawing on what you know. And it's not just the sense of embodied being in a particular kind of weather. It's also all the emotions that one feels. Your characters, wherever you're situating them, at whatever time and whatever place, they're going to have to feel things, fear and loathing and love and loss and longing and all of this. And you draw on what you know in order to make it real.
Yeah, absolutely. So that process of research then, I'm just thinking about how you carried that over into your book about creative writing, The Art of Writing Fiction. Because I know you've said before you rarely find writing pleasurable, and I wondered if writing that book was more pleasurable than writing novels.
Yes, it was.
It was.
Yes, it was. It's funny, because when I'm writing novels, I still feel as though I'm an imposter. I still don't feel authentically a novelist. I wonder, in a way, if that's my guarantee of authenticity, that so long as one feels like an imposter, one is going to be trying to improve and trying to resist complacency.
Do you think that's what happens when people get bad, when they become bad writers? It's because they believe they're writers.
Yeah, there is a syndrome. Its colloquial name is the X Factor syndrome. I think it's called the Dunning-Kruger effect. And it explains why, I mean, the episodes of the X Factor we all enjoy the most, or at least I used to, now I find them a bit painful, are those first auditions where you've got people who plainly have no talent, yet believe they do. And then you have these people who are all nervous and uncertain and unpromising, and then suddenly they start to sing and they have a voice, they have talent. Now the Dunning-Kruger effect explains this in terms of those who don't have any particular skill in any endeavor, but let's say writing, because they don't have any appreciation of what makes good writing, they can't judge the extent to which they fall short of the standard. So they think whatever they do is pretty good. And so you have these people auditioning for X Factor who don't have a voice, but they don't know it. Now, you do have these people who do have a voice, or to return to writing, who do have a facility for language and who read a lot and they understand what's required, and they can see the bar and they can also see how far short of the bar they fall. And so with someone who actually has talent, there's an inclination to underestimate their own abilities. And it's because they underestimate their own abilities that they may stop writing, they may just give up, they may become blocked, but they may also try that bit harder to improve themselves, to try and meet their ambitions, to try and make their achievement match their ambitions. It's It's because they're trying so hard that they do achieve something on the page.
Mm.
And so I often feel that insecurity is sort of your guarantee of authenticity. But that takes us a long way from your question, which was...
Was the art of writing fiction a pleasurable thing
yeah.
to write, and more pleasurable than writing actual fiction?
Yes. Yeah. So when I'm writing, I don't feel real. I don't feel entitled, and I doubt myself constantly. But I did discover 15 years ago when I joined UEA that I had a facility for teaching.
Mm.
And so I've always found teaching relatively easy, and it feels authentic to me. And that book is my teacherly persona coming through on the page. And quite a lot of it, not all of it by quite a long chalk, but a fair bit of it is derived from the classroom. It's exercises I've set in the classroom, or it's a kind of written up version of my classroom spiel. And a lot of the insights and understandings come from my teaching as much as from my writing. And I did sit down to writing it thinking it would be very easy, that all I would be doing is compiling my teaching notes, and hey presto, there's a book. But then as soon as I sat down to write it, I realised that actually it is writing. It requires a certain amount of craft and attention, and it became a much longer project than I'd anticipated. Not longer in the sense of pages, but just how long it took to write it. But it was still so much quicker and so much more pleasurable than writing fiction. I sort of believed in the person who was writing it.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay, I think we're going to have to stop, Andrew, but that's been really fascinating. Thank you. Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
That was Andrew Cowan in conversation with Bethan Roberts. You can find out more about Andrew on his website at andrew-cowan.com. And that concludes episode 327, which was recorded by Bethan Roberts and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 328, Chris Westwood explains how a fresh location helped him to reset his writing voice, and Emma Darwin recalls the early days of online writing communities. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.